talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. Tonight's show is a World War II themed special as we talk to the nephew of Sir Alan Turing about the incompetence in British code making during the Second World War. We'll also hear about the travels of Winston Churchill and how they shaped his view of the world, with a special look at his journey to the Yalta Conference in 1945. And we'll find out how the Luftwaffe lost the aerial war over Germany. You can email us your thoughts and views to talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Last week, we looked at the visits of Taoiseach to the White House for St. Patrick's Day and how the tradition evolved over the decades, and also explored the wider connections with Irish America. And if you want to listen back to this or to any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. We begin tonight's show, though, with the Enigma traitors. Everyone knows the story of Enigma and secret code breaking in the Second World War, the triumph of Bletchley Park over world-class cipher technology. Except that excellence in code breaking was nearly betrayed by incompetence in code making. From the outset, the Enigma secret was one of treachery, betrayal, and deception. And a new book tells the story of the people who fought behind the scenes for cipher security and of the Enigma traitors. The book is called Enigma Traitors: The Struggle to Lose the Cipher War. It's published in hardback by the History Press, and the author is Sir Dermot Turing. Dermot, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And we should say, first of all, that it was your uncle, Alan Turing, who, of course, is the celebrated hero of the code-breaking story and Bletchley Park.
Yes, that's right. This is a sort of an attempt to look at essentially the same set of circumstances, but from perhaps a slightly different angle.
Brilliant, because in previous works you've looked at the story of how Enigma was broken, but now this is a new dimension that probably we're not aware of, the fact that a code making was so incompetent that it proved to be a major problem, that there was this other side to the story of what was happening.
Well, indeed, the other side was literally the other side, who, of course, had their own code breakers as well. And I think we've got so mesmerized by the successes of Bletchley Park. I'm not trying to disparage them, but we've got a little bit mesmerized by that. And that sort of has blinded us, perhaps, to the possibility that the other side had their own code breakers and that they were actually very good at their job. And that meant that they were able to master British codes and later American codes really at a much earlier stage than anybody imagined possible. Just to take one example, the German naval code breakers were already reading Royal Navy secret signals before the war actually began. So the idea that convoy routing was going to be the answer to ferrying goods safely across the Atlantic, I mean, that was doomed from the outset because the Germans already knew exactly where the convoys were going to be sent. And the problem underlying all that was that, for reasons that are still quite difficult to understand, the British and indeed the Americans were still very attached to very old-fashioned code and cipher technology that had been invented in World War One, and nobody got around to changing it.
And there seems to be a stubbornness there, because you show how there were all these committees then to try and discuss what was happening, but they really weren't taking the decisive action to even recognise or acknowledge that this was a major problem.
Well, it will sound very familiar to your listeners that the British solution to things is to have a committee to sit down and discuss it, but not actually do anything. But apart from the fact that I'm laughing in this cynical way about it, that was a tragedy, because the consequence of failing to face up to the problem was that convoys continued to be attacked. Ships went to the bottom, and that's not just, we're not just talking about goods, we're talking about people's lives here, and that's pretty shocking, actually.
And what about the German side then? Because as you say, German code breakers were very effective, but then there also seems to have been, you know, a kind of a misunderstanding on that side about what was actually happening, that instead of acknowledging or recognizing that the Enigma code had been broken, instead they were thinking that traitors had been involved.
Yes. So this is a very curious thing. So let me just sort of fill in one little piece in the story. The reason that the British eventually woke up to the fact that their own codes were insecure was because they'd actually been reading Enigma transcripts, which basically, in which the Germans were passing on amongst themselves the intelligence that they'd gleaned from reading Allied codes. It's very convoluted, this story, but you get the picture. So the question then is, well, all right, if the Allies had been reading Enigma so diligently for most of the war, how come the Germans, who were reading Allied codes, didn't do the same thing? And actually, they were trying very hard to scrutinize the signals to see if there was any indication that Enigma was being read, and they couldn't find anything. So that reinforced the view in some of the German armed forces that Enigma was secure. So there were all these really unfortunate, unexplained bits of circumstantial evidence. And most particularly, again, just sticking with the war at sea, every time U-boats went to go and get themselves refueled or to rendezvous with another craft in mid-ocean, somehow the Royal Navy happened to show up at just the wrong time. And this happened not just once or twice, but it happens on dozens, and I'm not exaggerating, dozens of occasions. And Admiral Dönitz said, look, this is not explainable. It's not a coincidence. There's got to be something more going wrong. And so, of course, the answer came back, well, we know that Enigma is secure because, I mean, it's unbreakable, and therefore we have to seek out the traitor who is telling the Allies where these rendezvous are going to take place. I mean, and the more it happened, the more absurd it became. And the whole thing is sort of really quite remarkable, actually. But
And as you show, though, some of these German code breakers never had any real doubts about the security of Enigma. They knew that it didn't have the right level of security, and they knew that some of the Enigma models were flawed and dangerous.
I know, here's the problem, I think, that the German army and the German navy didn't talk to each other, and that's a problem that's not... you know, we shouldn't just blame the Nazis for that, because that kind of pattern of behavior is quite common. So they didn't talk to each other. And in the Navy, they said, well, we know that Enigma is secure. They hadn't talked to the experts, but they just knew it was secure. So they didn't need to ask the question. So they were looking for these traitors. Whereas in the Army folks had actually talked to the code breakers and said, what do you think about this Enigma thing we're using? What do you make of it? And they said, well, you know, it's probably not as secure as we'd like it to be. We think it needs an upgrade. And then the army folks said, well, yeah, but do we think that the other side are actually reading our signals? And at that stage, when they asked the question, the folks at Bletchley Park had not actually got on top of army Enigma. So there was no indication, there was no evidence that army Enigma was being read, because actually it wasn't being read. So they said, oh, well, all right, it looks like there isn't actually a problem at the minute, so we can defer this question for a year or two. And, of course, by the time they got round to thinking about it in 1944, it was too late. And so there's this sort of complete disparity of thinking between the two armed services in Germany.
How come the British codes weren't more sophisticated? Given that their code breakers were so talented and so good, why didn't they put the same energy or the same amount of time into code making?
That is the most difficult question, and I have to say I don't know the answer. I mean, they certainly did have a committee, of course, to think about code security in the interwar period, and they thought about buying a machine a bit like Enigma. And indeed, they actually invented something that was basically a ripoff of Enigma to try and increase security. And the RAF pioneered that and basically scooped the pool so that all the available cipher machines in the UK were bought up by the RAF and indeed by Bletchley Park. That didn't really leave many, it certainly didn't leave enough for the equivalent kind of rollout that the Germans had done with Enigma. So they were still stuck on these old-fashioned hand methods for encipherment. And that's where it all started to go wrong. I mean, they did wake up eventually to the fact that there was a problem and started fixing it by mid-1943. It's sort of where the corner is turned. But that's a very long time. And that's 4 years into the war. It's, you know, and you think that's pretty scary.
And I love this subtitle of the book. It's the struggle to lose the cipher war. It's not the struggle to win it. It's that both sides are making all of these disastrous mistakes. It's almost as if they're in a race to see who can mess up the most.
Yeah, and they're copying each other. I mean, without knowing, I mean, unwittingly, they're copying each other's sort of blindness and lack of willingness to think about communication security, even though they're exploiting the other side's communication insecurity. It's very strange. There's a psychological element to this, which, I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but I can sort of simply ask the question, and then you wonder, don't you, whether in the modern era where, you know, we celebrate organizations like the NSA and GCHQ and, you know, the equivalent bodies in other countries, and you just wonder whether they're actually making the same old mistakes. Are they so enthusiastically breaking other people's codes and not actually thinking about their own security? I hope I'm wrong, but you do wonder.
Where does Russia come into the story? Because, of course, as the war goes on, Russia becomes an ally of Britain. And Churchill gives a very interesting order that he doesn't want them to spy or to crack the Russian codes. And, of course, the Russians then also, as you show in the book, get access to some Enigma machines. So they're doing their own code breaking as well.
Yes, the Russian side of things is still a mystery. And again, this is one of the sort of odd ironies of sort of doing research in this area. Of course, the Russian archives are not open to the public. And so to try and actually find out what they were up to from looking at first-hand materials is basically impossible at the minute. But we have some little window on their world because the German code breakers during World War II had some quite considerable successes against their enemy, the Russians. And this was fascinating because the end of World War II, of course, instantly switches into the Cold War. And the Americans and the British were very, very keen to seize all the German records about Russian codes because they didn't have any information themselves because of Churchill's order. So we're depending on our ex-enemy to find out what we can glean about our new enemy. It's very strange. It's all inside out. This whole story is inside out.
And you have a fascinating look as well at what happened after the war, because there was a huge interest in wartime cryptography, and there was a huge interest in code making and indeed code breaking after the war, and to see how secure your system should be. And they were very interested in what had happened during the war.
Well, and this is a fact that had puzzled me for a long time, which is why the British in particular had been almost obsessively keeping the veil of secrecy across the Enigma story for years and years after World War II, and years after one imagined that cipher technology had improved so much that, frankly, knowing how things were done in the 1940s was sort of ancient history from a technological perspective. So why were they so obsessed about not allowing the public to know about it? And this trickled out really very recently. I mean, within the last 5 years, it turned out that the reason, or at least this is my theory. I probably shouldn't put it any higher than that. But We know for a fact that the CIA and the German Bundesnachrichtendienst, the equivalent of GCHQ in Germany, had been essentially allowing backdoors to be put into modern cipher machinery being manufactured and sold from Europe to various customers around the world. And those backdoors were allowing the CIA and other agencies to effectively get a quick win on codes and ciphered messages from various countries, not all of which were allied, some of which were neutral, and some of which may even have been on the other side in the Cold War era. And the idea that machine ciphers were inherently insecure and crackable, I think, was a subject they didn't want anyone to go anywhere near, because it was just too close to home. But I think it kind of explains, or at least it makes it a bit easier to understand, why there was all this sensitivity about the whole Enigma business right through to, you know, even to the 1980s, which, you know, frankly, 40 years after the war, that can't really be true. But it turns out that, well, maybe the kinds of machines that we were talking about in the latter half of the 20th century, way long after the war, were possibly exploitable using 1940s decryption technology. That in itself is very bizarre. But so yes, the whole Enigma thing seemed to have aftershocks that went on for decades beyond where you would have expected.
And the Enigma traitors, it wasn't so much people selling out the secrets. You suggest that it was the real traitors, as it were the people who were deaf to the concerns and who refused to listen to any potential warning and went on blindly doing their work.
Yes. One of the things that sort of metaphorically keeps me awake at night is the idea that the Germans were so close to discovering that Enigma had been broken, and so close to being able to read the high-level machine and cipher traffic that the Brits had were using for the very, very most secure communications. It could have been the other way around, that it could have been that the Germans were celebrating, you know, visitors going to their equivalent of Bletchley Park and saying, look, we only lost World War II because of the overwhelming force of the Russians and the Americans. But on the intelligence war, we were the king. And that's quite scary, because that could have meant that World War II was prolonged and many more people would have lost their lives. And, you know, it was so finely balanced, that what I've called the cipher war, that you know, frankly, there is no room for complacency thinking about this.
And it's not just a story about British code breakers or German code breakers. It is a much more global story, and very interesting the way you look at the Polish code breakers as well. I think Witcher was the name given to it, and of course it ended tragically for them as well.
Yes, well, they were the pioneers against the Enigma machine. They mastered the wiring and also the way to find the way the machine was set up every day. They managed to get on top of those problems well before World War II began. I mean, you know, seven or eight years before World War II began. Quite astonishing achievement. And then they handed over all their know-how to the British in 1939. And this is a tragedy, the Polish code breakers kind of disappear from history at that point. I mean, they don't quite, but their achievements deserve to be celebrated and given as much prominence as we do to Bletchley Park.
Has it been a blessing or a curse to have the same surname as your now celebrated uncle, and especially when you are writing about codes and code breaking?
Well, look, when I'm writing about codes and code breaking, it's definitely a blessing, because people possibly wrongly think I might know what I'm talking about. so that's a very good thing. In terms of it being a curse, well, It's a very unusual name, and so therefore people will tend to assume that there's a family relationship, which indeed there is. And then, you know, sometimes people want to come and sort of talk to you about slightly sort of random things, which can be interesting, and sometimes it can be embarrassing. But no, I mean, on the whole, definitely, I would say it's a blessing.
But is it an issue the way the story has been probably simplified to a large extent, that the story of, you know, in movies and in books, it's simplified, that the real, I suppose, story of the breaking of Enigma and indeed Alan Turing's life, it's become the Hollywood version rather than the real version?
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, there's a risk, I think, of sort of seeing it in sort of more one-dimensional way than perhaps it deserves. But having said that, I would say, you know, two things probably about that. First of all, I think that people are not stupid, and when they go to the movies, they know they're going to be entertained. And what it does, and here's the other thing, what it does is it sort of perhaps opens their mind and their imagination to find out a bit more about what really happened. And that's been a very good thing in terms of raising consciousness about, intelligence history, code breaking, you know, modern issues like sort of the role of AI in this kind of area. And on a sort of very sort of close to home level, I mean, it's been great for Bletchley Park because, of course, you know, lots of people wanted to go and visit the place where it actually happened, and that's helped the finances and survivability of that place. So, you know, so there's been lots of good things about it. And yes, all right, one can grumble about one dimensionality, but it probably doesn't matter at the end.
Returning to the idea of the Enigma traitors, I want to pose a counterfactual to you. Just say the Germans had listened to one of these code breakers who said, Enigma has been compromised, this isn't secure the way you think it is, and that would have had a huge impact on the German war effort. How do you think history would have gone? Could it have changed the course of the war?
I think my guess is that the outcome was assured once the Russians and the Americans were involved. There was no way that the might of the German armed forces was going to be able to withstand those two completely formidable opponents. So I think the outcome would always have been the same. But it's the real question is the amount of time it would have taken and the amount of bloodshed to get to that outcome. And the sort of nightmare scenario, the counterfactual that you're asking me to think about, is that maybe the Germans would have realized in 1941, maybe, that the Enigma machine was essentially old technology that needed to be superseded. There were alternative new machines that had been invented that could have been manufactured and rolled out in time. And at that stage in the war, it would have been industrially possible for them to do that. Later in the war, it just became too hard because raw materials were too scarce and the war machine was so devoted to producing tanks and ammunition and stuff that there just wasn't any manufacturing capacity to do sort of, you know, esoteric things like make code machines. So but I think by 1941 it would have been possible, and that would seriously have been a major body blow, maybe not a knockout blow, but a major body blow to the achievements of Bletchley Park and later the American code-breaking services in Washington. Just to sum it up, I mean, I think Harry Hinsley, who was himself at Bletchley Park and later wrote the official history of intelligence during the Second World War, his personal opinion, based on his research and his personal experience, was that what happened at Bletchley Park shortened the war by about 2 years. And I think we're talking about taking that away in your counterfactual.
Well, it's a fascinating story. The book is called Enigma Traitors, The Struggle to Lose the Cipher War. It's published in hardback by the History Press. The author, Dermot Turing. And Dermot, it's been an absolute pleasure and honour to have you on the show tonight.
Well, and thank you very much for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back to Talking History. Winston Churchill was truly a man of the world. In his long career as a soldier and statesman, and latterly as a global celebrity and artist, he visited and wrote about so many countries. And a new book takes us through the landscapes he encountered in a career almost unimaginable today. The Kaiser's Germany in the days before the Great War, the United States in the Roaring Twenties, the curdled delights of the Crimea during the Yalta Conference of 1945, and the French Riviera of the post-war years. The book is called Man of the World, The Travels of Winston Churchill. It's published in hardback by Amberley Publishing. The author is Robin Cross. And Robin, you're very welcome to the show.
Hello there. Yes, I'm delighted to be here.
We're, I think, always fascinated by the life and career of Winston Churchill, but this is an aspect of it that I hadn't seen covered before. So many books about Churchill, but this offers a new insight into that life by looking at his travels.
Yes, I mean, I think, in a sense, you can actually combine the two. You can write about the travels and the actual life story comes out. I mean, the two go together, but it's not a straight biography, but in a sense, there's very little left out via this mode of telling people about Churchill.
And he seems to have had this fascination for travelling, because he definitely seems to have travelled around so many parts of the world, United States and Canada, Europe, the Indian subcontinent, around Africa, the Soviet Union. He was a very well-travelled person.
Oh, yes. Well, I think the excitement of preparing to go and the departure were the kind of the mainsprings of his life, really. I think that's what kept him going, and then the return, and then off again. I think this is absolutely crucial to understanding the kind of chap he was.
So let's talk about some of those travels then. And the United States, I think, is fascinating because he got knocked down by a car in New York and had to get his medication, which included a prescription to allow him to avoid prohibition, which was ongoing at the time.
Yes, well, he had quite a nasty car accident in New York because he forgot about the fact that temporarily he forgot that the Americans drive on the right. And he didn't have, as it were, life-threatening injuries, but he was quite badly injured by the accident.
So let's talk about the Second World War and some of the most iconic journeys then, and his relationship, for example, with Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He would have been a regular visitor there.
Oh yes, I mean he'd only met Roosevelt once before the war, which was in I think 1918 when Roosevelt was Assistant Secretary for the Navy. During the war, of course, he was constantly in touch with Roosevelt.
In terms of that relationship, it seems to be an exceptionally close, and closer than with a lot of, even with politicians in Britain.
Yes, I think the thing about Roosevelt is actually, I think he emerges now as a kind of quite a mysterious figure. He was actually quite distant in a way. And I think probably Churchill didn't connect with him as closely as he did with Roosevelt's Eminence Grise, which was Harry Hopkins, with whom he got on extremely well. And Hopkins was the conduit to Roosevelt.
And talk to me then about Stalin and the relationship there, because what we see at the Yalta Conference in February 1945, a conference which was deciding the fate of Europe after the war, a kind of a different relationship there.
Well, yes. I mean, he obviously was taxed by many of his colleagues before he first met Stalin, about the fact that he was one of the very few politicians who wanted to see the war of intervention after World War I in revolutionary Russia, Bolshevik Russia. He was very much behind it, whereas most people wanted to get on with Russia, and most politicians disagreed with Churchill's view. So it was thought at the time that basically he would not get on with Stalin, and it was like a paradoxical notion that he would suddenly enlist Stalin's help. But in fact, the two got on extremely well, somewhat alarmingly well, in fact.
And in terms of the travels to Yalta, like, how did the geography and how did the travel there to, I suppose, what was quite a bleak terrain, how did that, you think, influence what was eventually decided?
Well, I think all kinds of things influenced what was decided. I think what a great deal of influence was the fact was Churchill's extremely vigorous appetite for both food and drink, which alarmed a lot of the people around him. And certainly at Yalta, it was very much in evidence, it fueled his energy, if you like. But he was quite unlike modern politicians in that sense. He had no shame about it. I mean, he might have been considered by many to be a glutton, but this seemed to propel him forward.
What about Ireland? Because, of course, he did spend some of his childhood in Ireland when his father was stationed there. But also, of course, his career impinged on Irish history quite significantly, including during the treaty negotiations where he was on the British team and would have got to know Michael Collins very well.
Indeed. Well, he was he got on extremely well with Michael Collins. Churchill was not the prime mover on the team that negotiated the Treaty of 1921, but he got on very well with Michael Collins because they'd both been in their men on the run. I mean, Churchill during the Boer War when he was an escaped prisoner, and Michael Collins when he was escaping Black and Tans. And when they met, and Churchill entertained Michael Collins in his Sussex Square flat in London, he pointed out that the price on his head was a mere fraction of the £5,000 that the price that Michael Collins had been put on his head, and they got on extremely well. And I suspect, had Collins not lived, of course he died shortly after the Civil War began, he might have become a member of Churchill's other club, this famous dining club, which of all his mates and cronies that met regularly at the Savoy Hotel. But alas, that was never to be.
Churchill, of course, in his travels saw how Britain's role in the world was changing as well, because in his travels before the First World War, Britain was this great imperial power. But by the time he was travelling after the Second World War, that was all changed forever. And how did that affect him, or how did that change how he viewed these journeys?
Well, I think the process began during the Second World War, really, because it was quite clear latterly that at the great wartime conferences, as they progressed, he was the junior partner in this triumvirate of Roosevelt, Stalin, and himself. And really, the decline which had begun after World War I in the prospects of the United Kingdom had really set in and was quite evident to those who noticed it during World War II and its aftermath.
And he doesn't seem to have hated travelling. I think people, as they get older, tend to perhaps view long journeys with a certain amount of horror. But he never seems to have lost his enthusiasm for making these great adventurous journeys around the world.
Oh, his relish for travel was absolutely phenomenal, insatiable. And although his health was never particularly good, he underwent a lot of tests initially in World War II to demonstrate that he could take these long flights particularly well without getting ill or anything. But he absolutely relished to travel. He adored it. And he was able to, I mean, for example, when he visited Stalin in the war, he flew over parts of Russia that he'd been involved but involved in conducting the war of intervention at the end of World War One. He could see from the plane, so kind of his own life and the own history that he'd passed through were all kind of interlinked, really.
Did the travels change how he viewed the world? Did you see it influencing his approach to foreign policy or his approach to politics?
Well, I think the two are separate, because during World War Two, his main concern, his absolute focus, was on foreign policy. And he left the dealing of with domestic policy to his coalition government, and that's one of the reasons why the Labour Party won the election in 1945. Because I think most people felt that that Churchill's wartime record was absolutely superb, but they associated his domestic political career before the war began with the Depression and other things, and therefore they put their faith in Labour to maybe change that in the post-war world.
Was there a particular place that he loved especially travelling to?
Well, I think he loved America, but also he also loved the south of France. I think particularly after the war, he loved going there, I think. But I think his absolute relish for travel really was a constant throughout his entire life.
And by the time of these later years, when he's visiting the Riviera and so on, was he this global celebrity? Had his leadership during the Second World War made him this figure of fascination for people wherever he went?
Oh, yes. And of course, he never had any trouble after World War II in making sure that, there were people queuing up, rich people queuing up to put him up for free. So he could go anywhere he wanted without having to dip into his own pocket, because just the privilege and pleasure of having Winston Churchill as your house guest was sufficient.
Very good. Well, Robin, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you tonight. The book is called Man of the World, The Travels of Winston Churchill. It's published in hardback by Amberley Publishing. The author, as I say, Robin Cross. And Robin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back to Talking History. Starting with leaflet drops in 1940, the aerial offensive against the Nazis' homeland grew into a huge armada that pulverized much of Germany, seriously damaging her ability to make war and killing hundreds of thousands. And a new book tells the story through the words of the veterans, as it provides an important account of one of the most controversial campaigns of the Second World War. The book is called The Air War Through German Eyes, How the Luftwaffe Lost the Skies Over the Reich. It's published in hardback by Amberley Publishing. The author is Jonathan Trigg. And Jonathan, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Great to speak to you.
It's a fascinating insight, but it's also an interesting approach to write it from the other side, to look at the air war through these German eyes.
I hope so. I mean, that's definitely what I wanted to capture. It's a subject that so many people have written about, and I wanted to come with a fresh perspective, a fresh angle. And I thought the way to do that was to approach it was, how was it for the Germans? The pilots who were up in the air fighting the battle itself, the gunners who were often children and women on the ground, and the German population itself who were under the bomb rain, as it were.
So an opening question, maybe. Why did the British bomb at night and why did the Americans bomb during the day?
Excellent question, Patrick. I mean, at first, you know, everyone was going to bomb during the day. That was the dogma that all bomber units around the world kind of went with at the beginning of the Second World War. And the British obviously were the first, because the Americans didn't come in until the end of 41, obviously. So the British started at first, and they decided they were going to go for daylight bombing until, incredibly, one small, considering the size of the campaign as it grew, what it grew into, one battle in December 1939, a force of 22 RAF Wellingtons, daylight raid on German naval installations, North German coast, German fighters attacked them, and the British thought the bombing will always get through. That was the mantra at the time, and they didn't. And so on, 12 of them were shot down, B-10 got back to base, and the British thereafter decided, really on the basis of that one encounter, that they were going to switch to night bombing. As for the Americans, they always believed day bombing, and their entire force of, you know, the ubiquitous flying fortresses. I mean, everyone can watch it at the moment in the Masters of the Air series. I'm on television and what have you. These huge four-engine bombers bristling with machine guns. The Americans thought they didn't need to fly at night, and that the bombers would be protected enough to be able to hit their targets during the day. And really, that set out the future, the entire campaign. For the British, it was always then going to be, we're going to fly at night in order to protect our bombers. For the Americans, it was actually, we can protect them during the day. That's what we're going to do. And they stuck with it.
And what effect did the bombing have on the German population, and what was the impact in particular on children?
It was seismic. The effect was absolutely seismic, particularly from mid-1942 onwards. By that stage, in the early years, the British were the only ones doing the bombing. And, of course, we made the switch night bombing, but we didn't have the crews that weren't trained to do that. The aircraft weren't suitable for it. We didn't have the technology. So it took us time to kind of get into our stride. But by 42, 1,000 bomber raids over Cologne and so on, and particularly when the Americans joined in, bombing from late 42 onwards and particularly into 43, the German population, for them, the war was always far away. Where their ground troops were fighting, Rommel in North Africa, and obviously the vast majority of their forces in Russia, thousands of miles away. But then all of a sudden, the war came to Germany, and it came to vast number of towns and cities. We weren't just attacking one or two cities. The Allied bombing campaign hit city after city after city. And so for the civilian population, it meant simple things such as at home, everything's blacked out. And so on. And you've got to make sure that the no light can be seen so that bombers could target, your city and what have you. But you had to have air raid shelters. At night, you couldn't sleep because there was lots and lots of not only attacks, but warnings that then didn't turn out to attacks. But as soon as the warning went off, down the stairs, into your air raid shelter, hardly any sleep. So the next day, you've got to go to work just as normal. And of course, it then starts to disrupt supplies. So it's more difficult to get food, to get clothes, to get around, to get to and from work, go and see family and friends. And for children, for them, it's a case of, well, we're going to have to start moving you away from school, and you're going to have to start manning along with, not just the teenage boys, we're talking about their sisters, and their kind of elder siblings and so on. We want you to start manning the searchlights. We want you to start manning anti-aircraft guns. And, you have this tragic situation whereby teachers would be cycling to the aircraft, anti-aircraft batteries, circling cities, and so on, so they could then give lessons to the boys and girls, sitting at their guns before they were used to obviously fire against the oncoming bombers. And as the raids got bigger and bigger, the war got on, obviously huge loss of life among the German civilian population, because the Allies simply didn't have the technology to, as we would see it now, smart bombs. You see it on those terrible videos where the cross is over one little car or one little building, in the bomb goes, bang. Then it was, if you could hit within 5 miles, you were doing well. And that meant that there were an awful lot of bombs landing all over the place, and that included huge areas of civilian housing and killing a lot of people.
So what was the purpose of the bombing? Was it to destroy the infrastructure, to destroy the war effort? Was it to force the Germans to redirect a lot of their resources away from other campaigns? Was it to break the spirit of the people?
To be honest, Patrick, you pretty much encapsulated all of it. I mean, at first, it started out from the British side about the ability to hit back. We've been shoved off the continent of Europe, Dunkirk and so on. And it's how does Britain fight back? And the only way they could do so was through bombers to bring the war to Germany. And it was a morale booster for the British population, and saying we're not just taking this lying down. There was definitely the desire to destroy German industry. They realized very, very quickly that the war machine needed feeding. And that needed feeding from the factory floor, back home in the Third Reich. And it was those workers making the panzers, making the aircraft, making the shells and machine guns and so on. It was destroy them. That's what we want to do. And then it became, how do we break German morale? Because we can smash factory and smash factory after factory and railway line after railway line and what have you. But in the end, it would need the German people themselves to put their hands up and say, enough. We don't want war anymore. We want peace. And the way that the politicians on all sides at the time thought the best way to do that was not just to defeat them militarily in battle at the front, but also to submerge Germany in a tail high explosive that would break morale and force them to give up.
And some of these bombing campaigns have been hugely controversial, and in particular the bombing of Dresden in February 1945 has always been discussed and debated and so on. Do you think it was a legitimate strategy by the Allies?
That is the toughest question of them all. Dresden in particular, you're absolutely right, has always been a centre of controversy. The main point always revolves around, well, the war had been won by then, so why was it done? And you know, there's always going to be pro and anti, you know, that argument. The issue for me, and I bring this out in the book, is the fact that, you know, yes, Germany wasn't going to turn the tables, and it wasn't going to suddenly win the war at that point in time. But they hadn't given up. They were still fighting, and you know, they were still sending our soldiers back in boxes. Thousands of men were still being killed at the front. I mean, the Soviets were still losing tens of thousands, and so on. And that was the point. It was yes, the Germans weren't going to win at that point, but they hadn't lost. And war is an ugly. I mean, as we can see it now in Gaza and Ukraine, war is an ugly, ugly business. And unfortunately, you know, we just have to fight until these things end. And that was the whole point. So for me, balance, and it is a hugely difficult subject to discuss. I think it was a legitimate strategy. We were in a war against one of, you know, if not the most evil regimes the world has ever known. And my God, we've known a few. And there really was no choice for us but to beat them. We had to beat the Nazis. You couldn't make peace with them. You couldn't live alongside them. We had to beat them. And so really, whatever we had to do in order to do that, I think was unfortunately a cost of war.
And when you look at the turning point in terms of that air campaign, was it the arrival of the American Mustang fighter? Because that was able to provide an escort then for these bombing raids.
I believe you're spot on with that analysis, Patrick. In, you know, the night battle was continuing, and the Germans and the British had reached a sort of balance. We're shooting down a lot of RAF bombers, but not enough to make that much of a difference. We were, and they just simply couldn't, you know, they couldn't do enough in the air during the night. It was too special. During the day, this was the issue. If they'd be able to stop Americans bombing, because they couldn't switch to night, so they could stop them bombing during the day, cause them enough casualties, would give them potentially a breathing space, enable them to build up their night fighter force against the RAF and so on and so on. The key was because they were, stuff was shooting down an awful lot of American bombers, despite their claims to the contrary in terms of how they were protected. As soon as the Mustangs arrived, one, they could keep German fighters away from their own bombers, but more importantly, they were given free range. So they were told, in effect, to go hunt. So not just, you know, fly around the bombers, provide protection and fairly passive, go on the offensive. So go and hunt the German fighters wherever they are. Of course, they weren't doing it in groups of 10 or 20, there were hundreds of American Mustangs at this stage. And sometimes there'd be up to 1,000 fighter escorts, along with the American bombers. And, you know, we are talking about vast aerial battles covering huge, huge parts of northern, southern and central Germany. And in that, you see German fighter units just being torn apart. Attrition that they were suffering from you know, the American Mustangs was unbelievable. Units that the Monday started with 50 fighters, and by Wednesday they were down to 12. And you can, you know, it imagine being one of those surviving fighter pilots sitting down there, you know, of an evening, and you're looking around going, there was 50 of us days ago, and now there's a dozen, and how long are we going to last? And the answer is not very long. And that is just, you know, it completely obliterates your will to fight. But yeah, I think the arrival of the Mustang was the turning point.
And by approaching this from the point of view of the veterans and their words and from the other side, did that change how you viewed this campaign?
Did to a large degree. I mean, I'd always, in a way, I suppose, considered that the Clyde Airmen and so on and their German counterparts, maybe didn't have, this is a horrible thing to say, but very true in terms of the way I looked at it, that they didn't have it as hard, perhaps, as the infantrymen, you know, sitting in the mud, and the cold and the wet, on a front line, being bombed and shelled and tanks firing at them and so on and so on. But coming at it through that veteran's perspective, very much from kind of both sides, although clearly with a German angle of approach, you start to understand just the horror of what they all went through. They're basically all volunteers and on both sides, but for that, you're fighting battle several miles in the air in one of the most hostile environments that our planet has, your chance of getting killed are very high or severely injured, and so although you're more likely to die, for the German veterans, for them it was their aircraft is damaged, they have to bail out, and they're literally falling through freezing temperatures for several miles on a parachute. And they're landing, half the time they've got, small injuries and what have you. And there's no, right, go and have a few weeks off and get better and what have you. It's literally, right, we're going to put you on a truck, get you to another airfield. There's a fighter waiting and you need to take off again and get back into the battle. Of course, for the Allied crews and so on, for them, it was exactly the same situation. Their aircraft be blown apart and they'll be lucky if they survive, and then they're just falling through, hoping that they'll survive on the ground, and that maybe the Nazis will actually look after them and put them in a prisoner of war camp and not kill them as soon as they reach the ground. So the admiration I took away from doing all of the research and the writing for all of them, is heartbreaking, really, for what they had to go through.
Well, it's a brilliant new book. It's called The Air War Through German Eyes, How the Luftwaffe Lost the Skies Over the Reich. It's published in hardback by Amberley Publishing. The author is Jonathan Trigg. And Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Patrick, thank you very much for having me. I hope people enjoy it.
Thanks to all my guests. My thanks also to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and to Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week. We've been talking history. Good night.